Andrew Jackson has been much in the news lately, hasn't he? Many people are making comparisons between President Jackson and our current president. After all, they were both outsider candidates. They were both populist candidates. They both vowed that they would go to Washington and shake things up and change the way things were done. But are such historical comparisons accurate or helpful? I decided to go to the source. I spoke to a fellow by the name of Dan Feller from the University of Tennessee, and Dan shared with me his insights both about Andrew Jackson himself and about these modern comparisons. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Old Hickory.
It's time for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Whether or not Andrew Jackson is comparable to our current president is an interesting question. But not the most important one. I've long intended to do an episode on our seventh president. He is such an interesting character and such a controversial character. In fact, some years ago, I went out to Nashville and visited his home at the Hermitage and even recorded a few interviews out there, intending to do an episode on Andrew Jackson. But all that visit convinced me of was that I didn't know what I was talking about, and I didn't know nearly enough about this president. So when recently I was reminded of the importance of Andrew Jackson by all of these current comparisons between him and Donald Trump, I decided to find myself an authoritative source. And fortunately for me, the guy on Andrew Jackson, one of the world's leading experts on him, works right down the street from me at the University of Tennessee. His name is Dan Feller, and he's actually the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson. He is a specialist in early 19th century American history, and boy, did he have a lot to say. So much so that we've decided to do not one, but two episodes about Old Hickory.
My name is Daniel Feller, and I am a professor of history at the University of Tennessee and also editor and director of the Papers of Andrew Jackson, which is a long-running UT project to collect, order, transcribe, and publish all of Andrew Jackson's extant literary record.
Well, wait a second, Dan. This guy's been dead a long time. I mean, you guys aren't finished with him yet?
It takes a long time to do this work.
Could you just give us a brief primer on Andrew Jackson, starting with where he came into the world?
Sure. He was born in 1767 in the Waxhaw Settlement, which is what was then the frontier on the North Carolina-South Carolina line, and the two states are still battling over.
I'd heard that. They both claim him.
They both claim him. Jackson, uh-huh, his entire life said that he was a South Carolinian. Mm-hmm. And the reason there is a dispute, he was born in one of two log cabins, and there's no way to determine which.
And they're on opposite sides of the line?
They are on opposite sides of the line that was drawn between the two colonies, later states, much, much later.
Right.
So,
are there like rival historical sites there?
Yes.
Come see ours. Come see the real end. Yep. Okay.
I figure a guy's entitled to be born where he wants to be unless there's better evidence elsewhere.
Okay.
So as far as I'm concerned, he was born in South Carolina.
Okay. And before the Revolution. I mean, that's something we tend to forget. We think of him as a 19th century figure. And,
yep,
of course, that's when he was president. But this was close to 10 years before we declared our independence.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he actually fought in the Revolution, not as a regular soldier, but as a kind of an irregular. He was something of a runner.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually captured by the British. And there's a famous story about how a British officer ordered him to clean the officer's boots, and Jackson said no, and the officer struck him with a saber. And Jackson had this gash in his forehead that he liked to point out. Whenever I tell that story, as I just did, I always say, this is the story according to Jackson.
Right. It's a much better than I fell off my horse one day.
Who knows what really happened.
Right.
But at any rate, he lost his family. His father had actually died before he was born. We don't know how. And lost his two brothers and his mother. And so he was an orphan at the end of the the Revolution.
And I'm guessing, given that he was born on the frontier in a log cabin, he was not from particularly well-heeled circumstances.
Not well-heeled. There was some money. Apparently, there was an inheritance left for him in Ireland because his family had emigrated from Ireland. And the story of Jackson's early years is really sketchy. Mm-hmm. Where it begins to fill out is that he read law in North Carolina.
This is after the Revolution.
After the Revolution.
Came back, okay.
Yep.
So in the 1780s.
Yep, got a smattering of formal schooling. Apparently taught school for a short period of time, which you didn't have to know much to be able to do.
Right.
Read law. There was no law school.
Right.
And then accepted a job as a public prosecutor in what was then called the Miro District, Western North Carolina, now the state of Tennessee.
Really?
And he moved out to Nashville. It's about 20 years old.
Let me just interrupt there very briefly. A couple of things. First of all, you told me something that I was only vaguely aware of, and that is that Jackson did have some formal education. He did have a profession. Now, he might not have been the most well-read lawyer in history, but he was a public prosecutor.
He wound up as a Tennessee Superior Court judge.
Well, so. Right. We're getting ahead of our story, though. But one thing I want to mention here, something we've mentioned on this show several times, going back to our earliest days, is that Tennessee used to be part of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And North Carolina, like pretty much every coastal colony, at least in the South, pretty much claimed as far west as they could. And so if you look at maps of that era, you see these straight lines going to the Mississippi River, typically. And then subsequently, those territories decided they wanted to be their own states. There was an abortive attempt to create something called the State of Franklin in eastern Tennessee in the early 1780s, before we actually had a constitution. And I think part of the reason we have a constitution that has an article that talks about how states are to be formed is because there have been a couple of abortive attempts along those lines. Tennessee was chief among them, perhaps. They actually had a small pitched battle over near Johnson City, Tennessee, over this. And then after the constitution was ratified and after that procedure was put in place, that's when Tennessee actually became Tennessee. But as a North Carolinian, he was living in what is now eastern Tennessee.
Yeah, okay, so actually Middle Tennessee.
Oh, he came all the way out. How far?
He came all the way out to Nashville.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, in its very early years, Knoxville was the capital of Tennessee, but Jackson actually moved out to Nashville, to the Cumberland Settlements, as they were called, when Nashville was really a pretty isolated frontier town.
Mm-hmm.
And he was public prosecutor, as I said, and he had also a law business on the side, as many of them did. Fell in with the Donaldson family, and the Donaldsons were actually one of the two founding families of Nashville, literally. And the patriarch of the family, John Donaldson, was dead, but his widow was still alive, and her daughter, Rachel, and Jackson and Rachel... this is a very complicated story.
Sure.
Let's say they eventually got married.
Okay.
Though she had been married before that, and to a really nasty man who left her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she and Jackson began living together as husband and wife. And then after the fellow whose name was, it's pronounced Roberts, I'm told, though it's actually spelled R-O-B-A-R-D-S, like Robarts. After Robarts divorced her, Jackson and Rachel then got formally married.
And this is a story that I know is going to feature prominently in, later in Jackson's life, but I'll just remark here that given transportation and communications in that era, such situations were not all that unusual, where one would leave and then, you know, what are you going to do? How can you get a divorce? You want to marry somebody else, you meet somebody else, you want to move on, but you're unable to. Maybe you do, and then you find out later on that you jumped the gun because the divorce wasn't final or there was no one to divorce. In fact, Alexander Hamilton was plagued his whole life as being called the bastard son of a Scotch peddler because his father had just disappeared.
Yep.
And leaving his mother in the lurch. And so, anyway,
yep.
So this was not that uncommon a circumstance.
It wasn't that uncommon. It was pretty, you know, as you said, it was a matter of realism.
Right.
By the time Andrew and Rachel began to live together and to show up in the newspapers as Mr. and Mrs. Jackson, Roberts was already gone. He was back up in Kentucky, which is where he'd come from. He had clearly abandoned his wife. At that time, in order to get a divorce, you had to get a special act through the state legislature.
Wow.
There was no regular provision for divorce. You had to get a special act through the state legislature, and you had to cite a compelling cause. So a lot of people were informally divorced and informally married. There was nothing unusual about it at the time. The reason that everybody knows the story today is that more than 30 years later, when Jackson ran for president, it didn't look very good.
Right.
Let's stay chronological.
I want to hear what he did in Nashville, now that we planted the seed. So he goes on and he's a judge.
He became a prominent attorney in Nashville and a prominent man and became wealthy. And we were just talking about this. I was at the Hermitage the other day.
His
plantation home, which is now a very good historic site. And one of the things they still don't know about Jackson is exactly how he got to be a wealthy man. Whether it was his law practice, his cotton plantation, because he bought a cotton plantation, his slaves, or his land speculation, because he was involved in all of these things, which was absolutely typical for a frontier young man of prospects, a young man on the make. But he became a prominent Nashville citizen. By the way,
the Hermitage is worth a visit.
Oh, yes, it is.
Is it east of Nashville?
It is on the eastern edge of Nashville.
Eastern edge of Nashville. It's a few miles out of downtown. I've been there a couple of times over the past few decades, and every time I've gone, I've enjoyed it. And definitely worth a visit. But please go on.
Yep. So he was involved in politics from the very beginning. He was a delegate to Tennessee's state Constitutional Convention. He was elected as Tennessee's first congressman, because the state only had one at first. And I'd have to go back and look at this chronological sequence myself. He didn't stay in Congress very long. He became a Tennessee Superior Court judge. He also ran for and was elected as Major General of the State Militia. The commanding Major General of the Militia was elected by the militia officers. So there was some politics involved in that. And Jackson famously beat the governor of the state, John Sevier, for that office. And that either led to or contributed to a falling out between the two, which led to an altercation in the streets of Knoxville.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yeah. The two exchanged insulting letters, which we still have and which we printed in the early volumes of our paper series. This is in 1803, I think. And Jackson actually challenged Sevier to a duel. And Sevier technically accepted, but they couldn't work out the details of time and place. And so the duel never happened.
Have your secretary call mine. Just couldn't set it up.
Well, this is one of the things about duels is that Jackson was certainly willing to fight duels, and there were a lot more challenges to duels than there were actual duels, because somebody would issue a challenge. Usually you tried not to outright decline a challenge, because that makes you look like a chicken. But the procedure for it was elaborate enough that there were plenty of exit paths before you actually show up on the ground, dueling ground, with a pistol in your hand. Now, that did happen with Jackson. In a duel, the one duel he actually fought in his life.
Not the hundred
that a number of news outlets are claiming. No, he actually fought one. He was in some lulus of fights, but a formal duel is a formal duel. He fought one. And the other story about that duel that everybody knows is that it was because somebody insulted his wife, and that's not true either. The duel started with a horse race that wasn't run. And the circumstances are really impossibly complicated.
But it was all about a horse.
It wasn't even about a horse. Jackson had a thoroughbred horse that he had purchased. By the way, that's another thing to throw in the mix of how he made his money. Jackson was a horseman. He had a horse named Truxton. There was another fellow in town who didn't like Jackson and vice versa very much anyway, who had a horse named Plowboy, and they arranged that seems I'm getting into the details. They arranged a high-stakes horse race with a forfeit. That is, you could buy your way out of the race by paying essentially a penalty if on the day you didn't want to run it. So Plowboy came up lame, and Irwin, that was the guy's name, pay Jackson the penalty. You know, then it's all done.
Mm-hmm.
Except there are various kinds of money circulating in the frontier at the time. And mm-hmm. so there was an agreement about what kind of banknotes Irwin would pay in. The story came out afterwards that Jackson had accused Irwin of trying to pay him off basically in bad money.
Ooh.
And Jackson denied that he had made, that he had accused Irwin this. But the charge was made against Jackson basically of being a... of being dishonest himself in leveling false accusations against Irwin. And from there, it went on to the point where by the time that Jackson actually got to the dueling ground, not with Irwin, but with another guy entirely.
Okay.
The origins of the duel were, you know, lost.
Right.
You'd have to peel back 15 layers to get back to what the original dispute was about. And instead, it's, we're on the dueling ground because you called me a liar when I said this, when he said that, you know.
Oh, my. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're speaking with Dan Feller, professor at the University of Tennessee and the editor of the Papers of Andrew Jackson. We're talking about the subject of those papers, Old Hickory, that fellow who was as tough as Old Hickory in battle. After the break, we will have our constitutional quiz, then we'll come back and speak some more with Dan Feller. Stick around. Well, it's constitutional quiz time, and who better to have in the studio with me than the quiz guy himself, Doug Smith, the director of the Center for the Constitution at the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Doug, how are you?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
I'm so happy to be here. I'm always happy to be here. I'm thinking of just clearing off the microphones and sleeping here tonight.
Oh, I thought you were going to start, like, dancing like feral.
I could do that.
Yeah.
Do a little bit of the
that was so
thing.
Popular 2 years ago. Now I wouldn't recommend it.
You don't think so? Huh?
Not so much.
Okay. Do we have a contestant?
Yeah, this is Sean O'Connor from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Charlottesville, Virginia. What do you do in Charlottesville, Sean O'Connor?
Do a couple things. My main primary job is a regular old 9-to-5 at SNL Financial, which is the former name. Now we're Standard & Poor's, S&P Global.
Oh, I heard of them. Yeah.
And now, you know, working at a vineyard on the weekend occasionally, Grace Estate. So shout out to that vineyard. Everybody should visit. Really good wine.
Okay. Thanks very much, Sean.
I hope we haven't violated any ABC laws.
I'm sure we haven't. I'm sure we haven't. Go ahead. What do you got? What do you got, Doug?
All right. So, Sean, I've got a riddle today. So I'm going to read the riddle, and then I'm going to give you four choices.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Sort of like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Kind of.
He's at SNL Financial. You can tell that.
Yeah, you can.
He's a financial services guy drinking wine.
That's right.
Here
comes. What we do all day.
Here comes the riddle. I'm a president, a Washington resident, whose presidency was not always mine. For good administrative order, not major disorder, I let the Veep hold my place in line. In each of both cases, the vice was just acting, but succession was never in doubt. Amendment 25 keeps the republic alive. In 3 hours, it had worked itself out. Which president am I?
Well, you got to give us some choices now.
Is it A, Abraham Lincoln? B, Franklin Delano Roosevelt? C, Ronald Reagan, or D, George W. Bush?
My. Okay, I think we need to have, we're talking about the 25th Amendment.
25th Amendment.
Deals with presidential succession. We know that from the beginning, but this is hard in the sense that it's a big old riddle.
It's a big old riddle. It's a president, a Washington resident, so it's a sitting president.
Okay.
whose presidency wasn't always his own.
Okay.
Well, why would that be? For good administrative order, not a major disorder, the president let the Veep hold my place in line. All right.
Okay.
So 25th Amendment.
Okay. I'm following you.
The vice president has a role here.
Uh-huh.
Sean, you keeping up?
Yeah, just hold on. I'm Googling the 25th Amendment.
Perfect. Okay. All right. While you Google, I'm going to keep going here. In each of both cases, so this happened two times, the vice was just acting.
Mm-hmm.
But succession was never in doubt. Amendment 25 kept the republic alive, and in 3 hours, it had worked itself out.
All right. We've heard it twice now. Sean? Any idea which of those four possibilities is the one we're describing here?
Is it A, Abraham Lincoln, B, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, C, Ronald Reagan, or D, George W. Bush?
I believe I can rule out the latter two. So that on the spot, I you know, obviously there's the whole Supreme Court Florida thing with George W. Bush, and then Reagan's election went pretty well for him. I think he won by a landslide of electoral votes.
Mm-hmm. I think what we're aiming for here, though, was there any president who was out of commission for 3 hours?
Yeah, incapacitated.
Twice.
Yeah, so was that when the assassination of Lincoln?
Okay, that could have been. I'm going to give you a hint here, though. I'm looking at Doug. How old is the 25th Amendment, Doug?
Ah, you're right. The 19th, or the Prohibition. So, yeah, that's you can roll that out. So,
I'm going to give you a little bit. I'm going to give you a little bit bigger hint because this just happens to be an anniversary year. The 25th Amendment is 50 years old this year.
Okay.
I think you can eliminate a couple of answer choices on that basis. So the 25th Amendment, which deals with presidential succession, 50 years old. Does that help you any?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So among your choices now, who are you going to go with? I think we can rule out...
Well, we can rule out the first two.
Okay. Yeah,
probably rule out Lincoln.
Right?
Yeah, that's probably a good call.
Yeah, probably can rule out Lincoln and Roosevelt. Okay.
By like 100 years.
So of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, who was incapacitated?
Twice
for roughly 3 hours and had to invoke the 25th Amendment.
Let's go with Reagan.
With Ronald Reagan, you think he was out of commission for 3 hours twice?
Yeah, because I wasn't alive during that presidency, so I don't know it as well. So that could be...
You're a young young whippersnapper.
Exactly. So I could be missing some pieces of history there.
Okay.
I don't feel like George... And you're talking about George W. Bush, right?
Mm-hmm, George W. Bush.
Okay. Don't remember him being incapacitated, but I could be forgetting something. So let's go with Reagan.
Final answer?
Final answer.
Doug?
Sorry, Sean. George W. Bush.
Sorry, Sean. I'm sorry. We gave you as much help as we could. It's what happened, and I think that was the key here, was understanding that it happened twice. You might have been tempted with Ronald Reagan because he had, you know, the assassination attempt.
Well, absolutely.
Right? And in fact, there's a whole backstory there. There are people who say he should have, or that Vice President, the first President Bush, who was Vice President, then should have invoked it. But literally, he was on a plane flying back to D.C. while President Reagan was in surgery, and the communications were sort of spotty, and they didn't actually invoke the 25th Amendment, so he wasn't actually acting president. And there was a big brouhaha when Haig, Secretary of State, he was Secretary of State at the time, stood forward at the White House and said, I'm in charge here.
Right.
Oh, boy. He put his foot in his mouth there, I'm afraid.
And years later, the doctor said, absolutely, the 25th Amendment
should have been applied. Yeah,
because it was that close.
There was no president for about several hours.
Right.
But the key here is that it happened twice with the President George W. Bush, and it was a routine reason, but it made sense. It was colonoscopies.
Yeah, and interestingly, with Reagan— it didn't happen after he'd been shot, but it did happen when he had colon cancer surgery.
Right. Well, it's understandable because you plan it.
Exactly.
Okay. And there's even discussion about that because he sent a letter saying he was mindful of the 25th Amendment. And so there's some question as to whether he actually invoked it or not. But nonetheless, he did it because it was planned. it's that much more difficult situation where it's unplanned, where maybe there needs to be a better procedure. But at any rate, George W. Bush, two colonoscopies.
And you're 3 hours, less than 3 hours each.
Right. I mean, basically from the time you go in there and you get the gas until you're out or you get the anesthetic, that was a very prudent use of it. So isn't that interesting? Dick Cheney was our acting president for a total of about 6 hours.
Yeah. And the key here is that succession was never in doubt. So if you think about it, how important the succession in an emergency situation of the presidency was during the George W. Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
They did a remarkable job of really going the extra mile.
Yep.
In every situation.
That was the prudent thing to do. The 25th Amendment's there to be used. At any rate, thank you very much, Sean. We are going to send you a pocket constitution, so get back on Facebook, send me a message, let me know your mailing address, and we will have one in the mail to you. And you can read the 25th Amendment for yourself.
Can you guys send it to our president instead?
All right.
Pennsylvania Avenue.
Thanks very much, Sean. We appreciate your time. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet. It's the Constitution. We should all read it
for the articles. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with Dan Feller. He's the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson and also a professor of history at the University of Tennessee. And Dan just has so much to say about Andrew Jackson that this has turned into part one of a two-part series we're going to do on our seventh president. Before the break, Dan was telling me that when he went into office as president, Jackson had a couple pieces of lead in him, because in addition to fighting in wars and engaging in a couple of street gunfights, he also participated in a duel. The short version is, though, that he ended up with some lead in him after this duel.
What happened was Jackson made a very gutsy decision. The guy he was fighting, named Dickinson, Charles Dickinson, was much younger than Jackson and was a famously good shot. And so Jackson made the decision that he wasn't going to beat Dickinson to the draw. And therefore, he was going to let Dickinson have the first shot. And presuming he was still standing there, he'd shoot him back. The way it goes is, you know, when the second who's presiding yells fire, you get to fire. You don't have to fire right away. Usually guys try to fire quickly. Mm-hmm. And so what happened is the second yelled fire. Jackson didn't do anything. Dickinson shot him, hit him in the chest. Mm-hmm. Jackson just stands there. And Dickinson started to back away, saying, you know, oh, my God, did I miss him? And the seconds at this point, the second is your aide at the mm-hmm. The second says, he kind of waves at him, no, you get back to the line.
Right.
You stand there. And Jackson took careful aim and pulled the trigger, and the pistol misfired. And there was a consultation of whether that counted or not, and it didn't. So then he took aim again very carefully and shot him, killed him.
Oh, forgive me. I shouldn't laugh at the death of anybody, but wow, what a way to go.
Well, what a way to go. And it's only afterwards, as the people who were there cluster around Jackson, that they notice this pool of blood.
By the way, I think you've been shot in the chest.
By the way, yeah. And Jackson said something like, oh, I think he's pinked me a little bit. Jackson later said that I would have killed him if he had shot me through the brain.
This is fascinating, but I know we want to get on to Jackson's more public life, but that plus a running gunfight that he engaged in left him with a couple of bullets in him.
Yeah, the other bullet in him, which was in his shoulder and was extracted during his presidency, came from a gunfight that he and a couple of friends had with Thomas Hart Benton, who was at that time a militia colonel, and Thomas Hart Benton's brother, Jesse Benton. Not to be confused with his daughter, Jessie Benton, who married John Charles Fremont.
Mm-hmm.
That happened in, was it 1813, 1814, in the streets of Nashville. And that is, as I said, it's right out of gunfight at the OK Corral. The Benton brothers stride into town armed to the teeth.
Right.
And Jackson and his two Confederates stride out into the street and they start fighting. And
it's high noon in Nashville.
It's high noon in Nashville. Jackson eventually chased Thomas Hart Benton, or was it Jesse, up the stairs of a boarding house, got shot in the arm at point blank range, And nobody died. Amazingly, nobody.
It's just boys having fun.
And nobody died.
The boys will be boys. Okay, yeah. So he's fighting duels. He is gunfighting in the streets.
Yep, one duel.
One duel. Okay, excuse me. It's a singular duel with a gunfight. He's got a couple bullets in him. None of this apparently has hurt his political prospects. Perhaps enhanced them. I don't know.
Actually, they did hurt his political prospects.
Okay, they did. Okay.
The Dickinson duel. Jackson was something of persona non grata after the Dickinson duel.
But he eventually recovered.
He did recover politically. So, the feeling at the time among a lot of people in Nashville, Dickinson was a young man, as I said. Jackson was well into his 30s.
Right.
And there was a feeling that he could have easily avoided this, which he could have, and that he was grown up enough to know better.
Right.
And Dickinson was popular among some people. So he actually was, his political career, for that and other reasons, kind of dead-ended. And what he was left with in the first decade of the 19th century was the militia major generalship. And that's where Jackson really found, in addition to his plantation, which was his livelihood, and his land speculation, and his horse breeding, this is where Jackson really found an avocation. And during the War of 1812, that avocation became a vocation.
Right.
He started out as Major General of Tennessee Militia, one of many major generals of militia in the United States, most of whom were not real military men. Jackson wasn't a military man in the sense that he'd had no formal military training. He never served in his entire life at any rank in any military unit below major general.
Starting at the top. Okay, then.
But he turned out to be a very, very competent and more than competent general. He took, even during the years of peacetime, he took his militia appointment seriously, and he made his men take it seriously. And the result of that was that the Tennessee militia, famously in the War of 1812, performed much, much better than militia from many states. The militia were supposedly, you know, every adult able-bodied male was a member of the militia. Most of the state militias were, I won't quite say jokes. Let's say they were unreliable. Jackson and his militia were reliable. As part of the War of 1812, they fought a kind of war within a war against the Creek Indians, which ended at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in 1814, when Jackson essentially annihilated the Red Stick Creeks, which was the faction of the Creeks that were fighting against him. After that, he got an appointment as the United States Major General. Well, that's a big jump from being a Major General of state militia to Major General in the United States Army. Mm-hmm. There were only a handful of them. There was no rank in the United States Army above Major General. And in that capacity, he was put in charge of defending New Orleans. And we know how that ended at the famous Battle of New Orleans in January 1815 at the end of the War of 1812.
A little after the war ended, right?
The battle was fought after the peace treaty was signed, right. Yes. And it had no effect on the peace terms.
Again, communications of the era.
Communications of the era. Nobody knew it. It was still a stunning victory. While it may not have been a meaningful victory in terms of affecting the terms of peace, it was an astounding victory and made Jackson a national hero, second only to George Washington.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm just sure you're having as good a time as I am listening to Professor Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee and the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson telling us all about that fascinating character. After the break, we'll finish our discussion for today with Dan, but fear not, this is only part one of a two-part series.
Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We look down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales and didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise if we didn't fire muskets till we looked them in the eye. We held our fire till we see their faces well. Then we opened up our squirrel guns and really gave them well. We fired our guns and the British kept them coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. We fired our cannon till the barrel melted down. So we grabbed an alligator and we fought another round. We filled his head with cannonballs and powdered his behind. And when we touched the powder off, the gator lost his mind. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
And now let's continue our discussion with Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee, the editor of the papers of Andrew Jackson, all about Old Hickory. Just before the break, Dan was telling me about Jackson's stunning victory at the Battle of New Orleans. So, Dan, tell me, what was so remarkable about this victory?
Well, everybody expected the Americans to lose. The two armies were roughly equal in numbers, depending upon who you counted. But the American army was a ragtag army. It was a small contingent of United States regulars. There were militia and volunteers from Tennessee. There were militia from Kentucky, with their famous Kentucky rifles, except most of them didn't, in fact, have functioning weapons. Mm-hmm. And they were not well-disciplined and well-trained. And in fact, they broke and ran early in the battle. And there were recriminations about that. For years afterwards, about who was responsible for that. There were free black men from New Orleans, whom Jackson had enticed to join his army. There was a small contingent of Barratrarian pirates under Jean Lafitte.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And these are facing British regulars. And there's a pattern over and over and over again in the War of 1812 and before that in the American Revolution. And that is when you put partly trained, haphazardly armed, poorly disciplined neophytes, militia, against regular troops, the militia run. They ran over and over and over again.
I think George Washington found that out early.
He did find that out. And in fact, a part of Washington's talent, and not only Washington, but some of his subordinates, Nathaniel Greene in particular, in the Revolution, was figuring out how to make good use of the militia and then get them out of there before they stampede and carry off your whole army, the rest of it along with them. So Jackson, first the British landed below New Orleans. Jackson launched a night attack on them.
And let's just pause here. New Orleans was key because then, as now, it's the major port on the Mississippi River, and the Mississippi had already become a major trading route.
Absolutely. Okay. It was one of the crucial choke points on the American continent. Jackson launched a night attack on the British right after he had heard that they had landed, which they did not expect at all. And the night attack wasn't decisive, but the very fact that Jackson would dare with this ragtag force to attack. And then he pulled back and built a fortified line in front of New Orleans, which the British assaulted head on January 8th, 1815. The peace treaty had been signed December 24th, 1814, but it was signed at Ghent in Belgium, and nobody knew that yet. Mm-hmm. And not only did the British lose, but the British lost altogether 2,000-odd casualties.
Wow.
And Jackson's casualties in the main battle, there was a secondary battle on the other side of the river. Jackson's casualties in the main battle, you can almost count on the fingers of both hands.
Wow.
And this doesn't happen, where you have a casualty ratio in the neighborhood of 100 to 1, especially when the 100 are the guys who are disciplined, armed, trained, veteran troops, and the people on the other side of this ragtag force. A legend grew up that it was all the American sharpshooters doing, you know, that these mm-hmm. Kentucky riflemen picked off the British at long
distance.
That's
where we've heard about the Kentucky rifles. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not what happened. Historians are generally pretty well agreed.
You guys ruin all the good stories.
Well, we ruin
all
the good
you
stories.
You ruin them all. Okay.
For one thing, the battlefield was so covered with smoke, you couldn't.
But I have to ask.
Let me tell you, though, quickly. There was an artillery duel several days before the main battle, which the Americans won, and some of the British guns were disabled. And the result of this was when the British were marching in fairly close formation, straight forward against Jackson's troops, who were behind, you know, cover, and there also was a huge ditch that they had dug right in front mm-hmm. of them. The American artillery just blasted them away. You start firing shrapnel.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but it sounds to me like this was more a matter of British incompetence than it was genius on Jackson's side.
It wasn't the British Army's finest.
Walking through a ditch without artillery cover toward fortifications directly in close order with the drummers drumming and the pipers piping mm-hmm. in red outfits, not the brightest strategy.
Well, in retrospect, it certainly wasn't.
I wouldn't think so.
You could say there was a little overconfidence there.
Yeah, there might have been. Okay.
On the part of the British. This victory was, again, stunning. Everybody had expected Jackson to lose, you know, for this to be one more humiliation piled on. Remember that just a few months before this, the British had occupied and burned Washington.
Yeah. People always say, at least on this side of the Atlantic, that the War of 1812 was a draw. My thought has always been that when the opposing army enters your capital and burns it to the ground, you got to chalk that one up to the lost side.
It was a draw in that the Americans had, in their own eyes, at least won some self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly not an American victory in that none of the grievances, which were the official reasons yeah. for the Americans starting the war. Remember, this was a war, we tend to forget this also. The United States declared war. The United States chose to declare war at a time and under circumstances of its own
invaded
making.
Canada
and
or
invaded
tried
Canada,
to.
Tried to invade Canada.
In Canada, they view this very differently than
yeah,
we do.
And
okay.
the Americans thought they were just going to walk into Canada, and that invasion, a three-pronged invasion, was a disaster on every mm-hmm. front. Yeah, the war didn't show the Americans to good advantage. But you come out with two miracles at the end. One of them is the peace treaty where the Americans at least didn't lose anything. Mm-hmm. It's simply
that's why they call it a law, because basically the return. But think about it. We're the ones with the grievances. We achieved none of our goals. We get rebuffed in our invasion attempt in Canada, and they burned the White House. I still say that has to go
but,
in the
lost but you
column.
But this is where New Orleans comes in.
Uh-huh.
You managed to completely humiliate them at the end.
Okay, that's the one thing. So Andrew Jackson helped us save face at a time when we badly needed to.
That's,
okay, so now we understand why people really were grateful to Jackson.
Yeah.
Okay. So this really made his national reputation.
That made his national reputation.
Okay.
He remained in the army afterwards, invaded Florida in 1818.
The Seminoles, right?
The Seminole campaign, so-called, right. or the Seminole War, in which, again, he showed his military efficiency and, you might say, his bravado in that he did or did not ignore explicit orders not to do what he did.
Mm, what did he do?
Well, he was actually ordered into Florida. Mm-hmm. Florida was a Spanish province, and the Seminoles, Indians who were in Florida, had been raiding across the border into American territory. Now, there had been incursions, in fact, on both sides, and, you know, who's the aggressor here? Is it,
right.
And who's the offended
a
party?
Long history, yeah.
Very much in the eye of the beholder. But the administration issued orders for an American army to cross into Spanish Florida in pursuit of the Seminoles, chastise the Seminoles, and then return. The orders explicitly said that the American army was not to attack the Spanish because that would create an international incident.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I said did or did not, the circumstances are confusing. It, again, was a a communications problem. These orders were not issued to Jackson, but to a subordinate general under Jackson's overall command. But then subsequent orders ordered him away and ordered Jackson to take immediate command. Jackson claimed afterwards that the orders given to not attack the Spanish didn't apply to him, and that he was given, as he put it, carte blank, which is carte blanche right. in Jacksonian French. He was told to chastise the Seminoles, and when you're ordered to do something like that, you're given discretion as to the means, and the Spanish had been harboring the Seminoles, and so he was justified in attacking the Spanish. He actually did attack and subdue and force the surrender of Spanish garrisons at St. Mark's and Pensacola. Mm-hmm. Fortunately.
West Florida.
Yes, this is in West Florida.
There Panhandle, were, right.
Yes, the Florida Panhandle. Mm-hmm. And he actually gave another general orders to take East Florida, but those orders were countermanded by the War Department. The administration finally decided to back Jackson over this. There was some discussion in the cabinet.
Who was president then?
James Monroe.
Okay.
And Jackson's immediate superior, the guy who had given these orders, all of them, was Secretary of War John C. Calhoun.
Yeah, I heard of that guy.
Yeah, who later became Jackson's vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And the Secretary of State, who argued in cabinet that regardless of whether what Jackson did was proper or not, he had done it and we should make the most of it. Was John Quincy Adams, who would later be Jackson's rival twice for the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
The administration backed Jackson.
That's interesting that John Quincy Adams would back Jackson, or at least want to take advantage of what Jackson had done at
and,
this
well,
point.
Because Adams was trying to get the Spanish to cede Florida to the United States anyway. Right.
Manifest destiny on the East Coast.
Yes, yeah. Well before the term was coined.
Right.
And Adams, the Spanish were... really, really good at being recalcitrant. Mm-hmm. That was their kind of diplomatic forte. Mm-hmm. And Adams had just been unable to move them off the dime on this. And Jackson's conquest, and then he did withdraw afterwards at the administration's orders. And Florida was handed back to the Spanish, but along with a very clear message, you know, you want to cede it to us and get whatever you can out of a treaty.
Or we'll just take it.
Or we'll just take
it again.
He
had demonstrated basically that we could march in pretty much any time we wanted to, and he was the guy to do it.
Exactly.
And he was ready, willing, and able. So that's what happened then, and the Spanish ceded Florida.
Yes, and the timing here, Jackson's incursion into Florida was in 1818. Spain surrendered Florida to the United States in 1819, in mm-hmm. what's called the Adams-Oneida Treaty,
right.
Also called the Transcontinental Treaty, because it drew a line also between the United States and Spanish Mexico, which included Texas.
Right.
But that's getting ahead of the story. So,
before we go on, we've mentioned twice now Jackson being an Indian fighter, if mm-hmm. you will, the Creeks first and over to the west, and now the Seminoles. Was there anything unusual in the way he fought the Indians? Were these more or less standard wars with the indigenous peoples, or was he a particularly cruel or brutal commander? I mean, he's got a reputation as not being very friendly toward Indians.
It's a good question, and I would say that he was not more brutal than most other commanders on either side.
Okay.
The history of these wars is littered with...
atrocities.
What we would call atrocities on both sides.
Right. Okay. So he was a typical commander then.
He was typical in the ferocity, I'll use that word, rather than bloodthirstiness, which
right.
implies kill for the sake of killing,
right.
which I don't think Jackson did do. But he was certainly a ferociously determined
I've always heard
commander.
It said that the Seminoles were never completely conquered, that they just retreated into the swamps.
Yeah, and the United States wound up fighting them all over again
right.
In the 1830s and 40s. And
that's a proud statement, and I happen to know a little bit about this because my wife is a proud graduate of Florida State University, mm-hmm. which has the Seminoles as their mascot, and that's caused some commentary because, of course, people are moving away from using indigenous peoples as sports mascots, but the Seminoles are very much in support of this. Apparently, they've got some sort of relationship with Florida State, and they're very happy to have that relationship. So that's an interesting historical footnote. They're mm-hmm. still there.
Yep.
They say we were never beaten. They're still there.
Yep. Jackson was not, at the time, accused of outright massacre anywhere. And certainly there were other American commanders and British commanders and Indian commanders who were. The battle that comes closest to that is Horseshoe Bend, which was his final defeat of the Red Stick Creeks.
And that was earlier.
This was in 1814.
Right.
Early 1814.
Isn't there an old song, in 1814 we took a little trip?
Yeah, that's...
Along with General Jackson.
Well, the song actually says Colonel, because you can't fit General into it.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. That was about Horseshoe Bend. Okay.
No, that's about the Battle of New Orleans.
Oh, okay, excuse me. I misspoke.
At Horseshoe Bend, there were a lot of non-combatants killed, and so many people were killed at the end that the line between a stunning victory and an outright massacre, gets blurred. Jackson's defense, he wasn't actually accused of a massacre, but Jackson's defense would have been, we were attacking an armed camp, which it was. Which unfortunately included women and children. And when we fire into the armed camp, we're not in control of who we hit.
Yeah. Nasty business. Okay, but I just wanted to establish that he was a commander. He did the things commanders did, but he was not particularly noted for brutality. In a very brutal time, he was typically brutal.
In a brutal time, he was typically brutal.
Okay, yes. Just trying to get a handle on that. Okay, so...
He did do some things that did attract criticism. In the Seminole campaign in 1818, at one point they trapped one of the Seminoles with a phony flag of truce.
Right, I seem to recall hearing about that story, yep. Yeah.
And another thing he did, which created much more of an international incident, because the Seminoles weren't in position to pursue a grievance at the governmental level. The British were, and Jackson scooped up two British nationals, one of them an army officer and the other one a Scottish trader, T-R-A-D-E-R. Tried them both by a very hastily convened court-martial of his own officers. Which is interesting. You're trying British nationals who are not formal combatants on Spanish territory for violation of American military codes.
Military commissions are not a new issue, is what you're telling me.
Yeah.
Okay,
got it. And what happened is the they were both convicted, basically, of aiding the Seminoles.
Aiding and abetting. There we are.
Seminoles. And the court-martial recommended the death sentence for both of them, but at least for one of them, I'd have to look recommended commuting the sentence or abating it. Jackson accepted the verdict, overruled the recommendation for leniency, shot one of these guys, and hung the other.
My.
And that had the potential to create a serious international incident, just as it would today. If you imagine, an American citizen being somewhere arrested, summarily tried by a military court, and executed by a foreign power,
in very shadowy circumstances, where the law is not clear, nor is jurisdiction clear.
The British decided, not for their own reasons, not to pursue that issue.
Oh, I hate to interrupt this tale just as we're talking about Andrew Jackson kicking some serious British booty down in New Orleans. But never fear, Dan Feller of the University of Tennessee will be back next week to continue the story. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.